Hello and welcome to Irreverent Testimony, brought to you by Netroots Radio, the political podcast by and for millennial and Gen Xer types from a left-wing perspective. It is Friday, July 22nd, 2016, and Rachel and Dana are with me tonight, and we have a super awesome special guest, writer for Raw Story, Miss Sarah Burris. Hello, Sarah.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
Hello.
Thank you so much for joining us. We got so much to talk about, but first, the most important thing. Which did you find more disappointing, the VP selection of Tim Kaine today or the X-Files reboot?
Oh, Tim Kaine. I love the X-Files reboot. Are you kidding me?
You're the one.
I loved parts of it, too. I'm a huge X-Files fan. Dana got me into it when I was a kid, and I really loved certain episodes, and then others I was like, oh, what are we doing? But Tim Kaine, definitely greater disappointment, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, that sort of leads into the whole first segment here that I'd like to discuss. Obviously, we are mostly millennials here, and our focus is on getting and keeping millennials involved in the political process. You, of course, are a millennial journalist and political beat writer, as it were. And I know you have sort of the same issues and concerns as we do. Obviously, there was a setback with not getting our number one choice in Bernie Sanders. And then we got dealt sort of another blow today when even though you can certainly make a strong argument that the VP is very just ceremonial and sort of useless and what have you, we were hoping for somebody that was a much better draw for millennials a la Elizabeth Warren or Cory Booker or Tom Perez or literally anybody but Tim Kaine, almost.
Yeah.
But instead, we got the milquetoast, moderate-ish white dude from Virginia. And so I guess my question is, and I've got like quite a bit to say about this whole thing of why we kind of got what we deserved in Tim Kaine on a more macro level. But before we get to that, like, how do we get?
How do you feel about it?
Yeah. First off, how do you feel about it?
So I'm completely with you. This is total milquetoast. I do disagree that the vice president is largely ceremonial. The last two presidential administrations, we've had vice presidents who have been really involved and really important. And I mean, Joe Biden does a whole lot of foreign policy stuff. I don't know if you guys get the press updates every time the president or the vice president sneezes from the White House, but I'm constantly finding out like every single phone call that the vice president makes to some head of state in some other country. And at the same time, now he's on his crusade for the cancer moonshot. Like, he does really important things. And we all know that during the Bush administration, Dick Cheney ran everything.
Pretty much, yeah.
Right.
True.
Just as Mike Pence would in a Trump administration.
Yes.
Exactly. Which is something to be really afraid of.
Yes.
I don't know if that would be the case with Hillary Clinton. I feel like Hillary Clinton is a little bit of a control freak.
Yeah.
Bless her heart. We can smell our own. I will own up to the fact that I am
the same
a total.
Thing. Yeah, me
right.
Too.
Like,
yep,
I'm a completely control freak.
That is the Clinton way.
Right. Exactly. So I don't know if that would be the case with her. If he's going to end up just doing ribbon cuttings, or if he's going to have actual stuff to do.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
At the same time, you don't have, like, the White House sets the agenda, but the White House doesn't set the laws. Congress sets the laws. So I don't feel like, Tim Kaine's milquetoast, like, he's not really that great on choice, for example.
Yeah.
Getting better, but not perfect record, certainly.
Yeah, but definitely not perfect. But Clinton, however, is, I mean, that's the one issue where she is sure to nominate Supreme Court justices who are not crazy.
No question.
Yes. Right.
Yes.
So I feel like those are good things. When it comes to this ticket in general, you know, I'm not excited about it. But at the same time, you look at Congress and the Senate, nothing's going to move. Like, the Clinton administration, good on them for saying they want to do all this stuff. Nothing's going
to
happen.
Well, I disagree with that to a certain point. And maybe our standards have become so low for government actually functioning. But at least if we take the Senate back, we can confirm judgeships and fill all these vacancies and get like the bare necessities of government moving forward at the very least. But no, you're right. As far as sweeping legislation, I don't think there's a chance in hell unless this is a wave election like we're not even anticipating, and which is possible that Trump like just totally melts down and starts like shouting the N-word and firebombing people, that like that we could just have this crazy sweep where we have such incredible control of the three branches that we just move all the sweeping legislation through. But that's probably not going to happen. You're right about that.
And I think, honestly, until we get gerrymandering fixed, until we get the new census and we have an election with the new districts, which is a major thing. Like, we have to start operating the way that the Koch brothers did whenever they lost the White House and decided, okay, we're going to go win all of these state legislatures completely change congressional districts. Like, we have to do that. The thing that I feel like the Clintons have been pretty good about in the last couple of years is they show up and raise money for Democrats.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that, you know, we'll have enough people that they'll show up for and that they'll raise money for, and we'll have some Democrats on the ballot.
And that's another thing that I think is so funny is the Bernie Sanders, Bernie or Breast, Bernie Bro people didn't understand about why the superdelegates weren't going to back Bernie Sanders. And it's like, did you spend the last 30 years campaigning for Democrats and the Democratic Party and the Democratic platform and being involved in the fucking process? No, you were an independent. So when you decide to run as a Democrat, the party doesn't have the same sense of loyalty to you as it does to the Clintons, because they've been working for decades for Democratic candidates.
And understand, this is coming from a room full of Bernie supporters. We caucus for Bernie. We caucus captain for Bernie. We believe.
And I also fucking love Hillary. I'm not going to mince words about that. I think she's great. And I'm super excited to have a female candidate. And I think she'll win. But yeah, I think it's, you know, it was frustrating for me that the Bernie people just didn't understand how party politics works.
And I would say, too, they still don't understand. You've got a seriously important race in Florida where Debbie Wasserman Schultz has an opponent in that district. And if the Bernie folks are furious with her and with the DNC, why the hell aren't they donating to him? And
why aren't they knocking
doors for him and making sure he gets elected? Like, this is not about just Bernie Sanders. What I would love to see both the Bernie bros and the Bernie babes and Sanders himself do is take that populist message, take who Bernie Sanders is, and take it down ticket to every state legislature, and fight for his values all over the country.
Well, it seems as though he started to build some sort of organization to do that. Isn't that right, Dana?
I was just going to say his Twitter during the RNC has been extraordinarily active. You know, post the Hillary endorsement, it seems like the entire Bernie Sanders staff is still operating with kind of the same furor, but now looking more at like down ticket. And I want to rewind just a tiny step and say that, you know, being in line to have the right people around to make decisions about drawing house districts when the census happens in 2020 is one of my very pet projects. I think I mention it on every podcast.
Absolutely, yeah.
Good.
It's critical that Democrats be the people who make that decision, not just to undo the damage that's been done, but just to make sure it doesn't get any worse, because the way it is right now is insanely...
it's impossible for us to win. No matter if we have the popular vote, we can't win because of the district.
And it's these bigger... macro big picture issues that we have the hardest time getting through to our Bernie or bust compatriots.
Yeah,
well, that's because they threw themselves behind a particular candidate who had a larger message, but there's no
but they don't see the big picture that none of this is going to come to fruition if the Supreme Court gets stacked with four more Scalias. Or I mean, they won't be as smart as Scalia, but they'll be as crazy. And
well, here's what I said the other day. I was having this argument with a dude that I actually really like on Facebook. And he was telling me all about how he was going to vote for Gary Johnson because he hates Hillary and he hates Trump and they're basically the same. And he's a middle-class, white, straight dude. And I said, you know, if Trump wins, you are voting to take my rights away and the rights of my people. And so have your revolution, but don't have it on my back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like this affects me and mine way more than it does him. And he never did get around to addressing that because, of course, but that's the thing that I want to yell and scream off the rooftops is, okay, you hate Hillary. I don't care. They're not equivalent, Hillary and Trump. They're not. And
yeah.
What will happen to my rights and the people like me are devastating.
Not to mention people of color
exactly.
And Muslims.
Yeah.
And LGBT people.
That's
exactly.
Me. That's me.
Yeah, no, what's
yeah.
The tweet?
So women, LGBT people of color, people of different religions than Christianity, poor people, their lives will be directly and immediately affected by a Trump presidency in a way that it may take a few years for the straight, rich, white dudes to feel. And so it's not about you. It's about us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, I was just going to ask Travis for the word for word, what's the tweet pinned at the
top
of our
Twitter
account?
The people that say, you know, how bad could a Trump presidency be are the ones that can inevitably afford, or so they think, for, you know, four
exactly
years
right.
of a Trump presidency. But, that's kind of where we are. And even smarter people who should know better are missing the big picture. I'm not going to mention Susan Sarandon because I don't assume she's necessarily smart. But, you know, Michael Moore and people like that.
People with a lot of space to say a lot of things.
But like, do you really think, okay, we didn't get the revolution right now. Do you think it's going to hasten that to set us back on the Supreme Court and in Congress?
That's what I was saying. Yeah. And he was like, well, I'm looking ahead more than 4 years. And I'm like, no,
you're not.
Looking ahead on decades of Supreme Court decisions that will roll back minority rights, voting rights, women's rights, reproductive rights.
It's like they never
LGBT
learned.
Rights,
this is
like,
the same argument they made in 2000. Well, George Bush will be so horrible that the progressive revolution will take everything over and will sweep into power in 2004.
Nope.
And it's like, dude.
How'd that work out for you?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so exactly. We got 8 years of George fucking W. Bush.
Right.
Congrats. Congratulations that you voted third party.
And Alito and Roberts.
A lot of the professional left got a lot of money and a lot of jobs. And, you know, so there's that. But, you know, legislation sucked and we will feel it for 20 years still.
Absolutely.
Oh,
I mean,
if not more. Yeah.
On the,
there's still
what
voting
been...
to pass the damn Patriot Act.
Right. Yeah.
Well, and like what has been essentially a neutral court with, you know, 4-4-1 who will always go with law enforcement, but for the most
pretty
part,
pretty good on women,
pretty
Kennedy.
Good on women's mm-hmm. issues. That really hangs in the balance. I mean, we've got one vacancy. Ruth Bader
couple
Ginsburg,
more to come up. Uh-huh.
Unless my plan to turn her into a cyborg comes to fruition, she's not.
She may already be a cyborg.
She's going down with the ship. Like that. Yeah. She's going to be like Robert Byrd, who's going to die like in her chair. There's no way you're going to get rid of her.
Did we say
so.
She's
going
to be a brain
so
in a jar? Just like hooked
up
to
I'm
a
fine
speaking
with that.
Machine?
I'm completely fine with that. Just put a brain in a jar that is her and then like build some kind of system that reads it. And that can be for the next century. I'm fine with that. As long as RBG's on the court, I'm good. Yeah.
From a technical perspective, that's really not that hard to achieve.
Great.
I think that's
invent
like right
that,
around
please.
The corner.
Let's
so.
Do it.
If they could do it on Futurama, I feel like.
Right. Yeah, but then they could do it to Thomas. We don't want that.
No, oh,
Robert.
God, good
yeah,
point.
No, good point.
No, they're all going to heaven.
About,
so.
Oh, that's true. Right. They don't want to be brains in jars. They, no, want, yeah. they want their express tickets.
They want Jesus.
Their 70, yeah, Jesus. Their 70 versions. Or, oh, wait, I'm confusing that with something else. Whatever.
Okay, so I want to ask you something else. So you, Dana, and I are millennials, and I feel like our generation gets a pretty hard criticism in the media and by the older generations. And we had a podcast a couple weeks ago about having seen Cory Booker and how he was talking about generational decency. And our friend Arliss, who is a boomer, wrote me a very long email about all the things that her generation had accomplished. And she wasn't wrong. And I appreciate that. But I feel like our generation just gets shit on constantly. And I'd like to hear what your thoughts are about that.
So I feel like I feel like every older generation in history has continued to say kids these days,
yeah.
You know, kids these days with the hair and the music, right, is what they used to say.
And the language always.
Yeah, every single generation in history shits on the younger generation. And what has always bothered me is that people like to shit on us, and I'm like, dude, you made us.
Yeah.
Right.
We are in your image.
If y'all got a problem with it, you got only yourselves to blame, first of all.
You made this.
Yeah.
You built this.
Yeah.
But secondly, whenever it comes to particularly boomers who want to shit on millennials, I'm always like, y'all ruined my country.
Yeah.
You killed our generation by sending all of us to war. You completely destroyed our economy. You ruined my country, and you left me to clean up your mess. So shut the fuck up.
Well, and then they call us selfish in the middle of it.
Okay, hold on. Interject on, because, you know, if our friend Arliss was here, she would say, yes, but we also passed the Civil Rights Act.
Yep.
We did end the war in
Vietnam.
Clean air, clean water. Yeah.
And it's so great that they did all of those things. They're destroying them right now in Congress.
Yes.
Boomers are destroying all of the good things that they did.
Well, yeah.
They got rid of the Civil Rights, not the Civil Rights Act, but they got rid of
the Voting Rights Act.
The Voting Rights Act.
Yep.
So, and you just saw, I think today or... I think it was today where Terry McAuliffe in Virginia tried to
get the felons reinstated, their voting rights reinstated, and the Supreme Court shut it down.
The state Supreme Court said no, good try. So I mean, like, that is a big deal. It's all great that we have clean water and, you know, Cleveland's river is not burning anymore, but you're pumping all your damn fracking chemicals into my water.
Right. I was going to say, what about Flint, Michigan? And I mean, like, we can't really tra-la-la, our water's so clean now. Thank you for doing that.
Well, let me connect those dots with what I think you guys are saying, because you talk about a generational thing, and this every time that the talking heads say, well, the Republican Party is dying and conservatism is dying because – all these young voters are all on the side of all this progressive stuff. I'm like, yeah, our parents were too.
Yeah.
And something happened as they got older.
So
Coke that they snorted in the 80s.
Right? No, I'd actually like to posit a theory, which is that the way that from a progressive point of view, things are not going very well as far as all the things that we were just talking about, Clean Water Act being removed, Voting Rights Act being...
gutted.
Gutted. What I think is happening is there's a certain number of people who are of the boomer generation who got into a place of power where they're still having arguments about things that our generation, or at least progressives of our generation, consider to be settled issues from 35 years before we were even born.
It's part of it.
Yeah.
And they're continuing to have the argument and kind of have a temper tantrum
in a
vacuum. They lost that argument in 1968. And... now that they've got the opportunity to have the floor again, just because by virtue of their age and...
It's also not a level playing field, because they weren't saddled with the kind of debt we were saddled
exactly.
with.
Exactly.
They could afford to buy a home with one income, which is no longer a thing.
Go to college and pay it off within a couple of years.
Yeah.
Get a good job.
But yeah, to finish the thought, I mean, we're talking about somebody who's on their like fourth term in Congress, and they're given the floor. They bring up an argument that, by and large, our generation considered to be a settled issue by the time we were even born. And they're arguing about things that we take for granted, I guess, and say, like, well, obviously, we're going to go that direction. And somebody brings up something out of left field that is an argument from when they were...
their fathers were in power.
Or when their fathers were having arguments about it.
Well, this is a really interesting discussion, and it leads me to, now, we did not watch Trump's speech in real time.
No.
Because we were at
a
musical performance.
Uh-huh.
But it's interesting when you're talking about the people that are, quote, so angry. But the reality is the people that are so angry are really mostly doing okay.
Yes.
And the people who are really, really struggling – don't vote conservative.
That's right.
And
that's
the exactly media correct. Never really makes that connection.
Right.
So it's like part of it is perception, and the other part is the, as we've talked about a lot, the loss of privilege.
Yes.
That absolutely. These immigrants and brown people are in some cases starting to do a little better, or they get the same benefits that I need as a white person.
Or that you've always had.
Right.
Yeah. And then when you see someone else get it, there is this reflex, I think, of a sense of loss of privilege.
Like, and throw in a little Islamophobia and
xenophobia and homophobia.
Blue Lives
sexism.
Matter stuff. Mm-hmm. And there you go. You get this toxic stew of crap that rises up in the form of Donald Trump.
I also think this article that I read a while ago talked about generational gaslighting and how the boomer generation really is trying to gaslight the millennials into thinking that we are really selfish and we really don't have a work ethic and we really aren't trying. And they're completely ignoring the reality that we live in, which is that we're in an economy that is doesn't value us at all. We have to work harder to get a job and keep a job than any generation ever has in the history of our country. The housing market shit all over us. We pay more for our college education, and it's required now as opposed to a perk
optional.
Back then.
Yeah.
You know, optional. I mean, they're trying to say that we're these selfish, entitled little cunts, and it's like, no. We are literally living in our parents' basements, not because that's the way we prefer to live our lives, but because we don't have any goddamn options.
Not
our fault.
Nobody wants to live in their parents' basement.
No one.
Well, and not only that, but with like the rise of automation, I know that this has been a huge part of a lot of people, but what is actually expected out of you for an output for a day's work is something that we weren't necessarily taught when we were raised. We were watching our parents do their jobs, and for the most part, a lot of them still have something in the same sector and whatnot. But when we show up as an entry-level employee, we're expected to do 3 or 4 times as much as
and have 3 or 4 years of experience to get an entry-level job. And it's like, what the hell am I how is that a thing?
Yeah, no, watching things like, you know, the Flintstones or the Jetsons, where somebody's job was to make sprockets for Spacely or like,
and that was in the future.
Or, you know, going the other direction, you know, just like a mine. No, the way that technology has progressed, we're expected to be able to do so much more with so much less. And that was not what we were taught to do. We're using the same educational programs that are...
And our wages haven't increased since years and years and decades. And so cost of living has gone up, but our wages have stayed stagnant. So we can't afford to buy cars or houses or anything else without advanced degrees, which... cause us even more debt. And you know, and then it's, oh, you're all selfish and you have no work ethic, and it's like, fuck you.
So besides my usual line of saying it he who smelt it dealt it, that the people who are saying that the millennials are the me generation or the selfish generation, for the 1,000th time, just for the cheap seats. But on top of that, I would like to say that there has been some good news recently, that a lot of very large corporations have been, just because of the way the job market is working right now, been increasing their starting wages and their living wages.
Yes.
So Starbucks, McDonald's, Walmart, all of these places have made really...
And that didn't happen in a vacuum. It took people walking out, striking, lots of bad press, lots of litigation and intimidation tactics by these companies. You know, this stuff doesn't happen by accident. It takes a lot of activism and a lot of work and a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, and people putting their jobs on the line they desperately need, they could easily just get fired from and then have no recourse.
So I think that's a significant part of it, and I certainly agree with everything you just said. But why I think so many large corporations are kind of doing it in tandem together is they realize that they're kind of fighting one another for essentially the same untalented job pool. Well, not untalented, but...
Unskilled.
Unskilled. Yeah. And they realize that if one of them does it, it's kind of a domino effect and they all need to do it. And the way things are working right now is it is a worker's market. We can go find somewhere pretty easily that will probably pay us significantly better than a place that we've worked 2 or 3 years.
It's still not a living wage, but, you know.
We're making some
progress. It's something.
Yeah.
No, that's...
And I think, too, for the millennials who are middle class, who have managed to parlay their overpriced education into a decent job, and, you know, rent a moderately priced apartment. I think that we have the luxury to sort of vote economically with our pocketbook, where there are enough options that exist for us. Like, I can go buy a coffee anywhere.
Right.
And if your company is going to prove to me that you're taking care of my people and my friends who work there, and that you're paying a decent wage and giving people health care, like, that's going to help their bottom line, because we're a huge purchasing demographic.
I'm really glad you brought that up, Sarah, because I've been thinking about this, and the press doesn't talk about this. You know,
no, but every marketing person in the country knows about it.
That's really cool, because I was thinking this a couple years ago. I was thinking, at a certain point when I started doing a little better financially, I said, you know what? I don't really want to patronize McDonald's. I don't want to patronize Walmart.
Yeah.
And I could afford not to.
Yeah.
I could afford to pay a couple bucks more or drive a little farther to Target, which isn't necessarily much better, but at least it's not Walmart.
Or a local coffee shop.
Or a local coffee shop.
Every trans person can, like, can choose their bathroom.
Exactly.
And they don't have boys and girls sections of toys.
But my,
my
point was, I was thinking, like, I can't be the only one who's consciously doing
this.
That's
the thing about the millennial generation, is that we are very cause focused, and we always have been. I mean, it was the case very early on when millennials were in college, that we, I think Facebook rolled out their causes platform. Remember that?
Yeah.
So yeah, I got called a social justice warrior.
I do.
It was really important to, like, wear your cause as a badge and shit like that. So, like, we have always been this generation who looked at, you know, what can I do? How can I use my life to make the world a better place?
You know,
even if it's something as mundane as, like, choosing Target over Walmart or, you know, something like that. Like, we're really doing, living our values, which
absolutely.
I think is awesome for us.
Now, and I think for our generation, I absolutely blame the last, like, 3 minutes of each TMNT, He-Man, G.I. Joe episode.
All those PSAs.
Yeah, all those PSAs.
Skeletor telling you not to use drugs?
Yeah, exactly. We were taught, like, this is how you live, and if anyone tells you differently, they're out to get you.
I also think our generation gets accused of identity politics. That, hey, if you just sign a petition or don't shop at Walmart.
Hashtag activism.
Exactly. That doesn't make a difference. But I think, first of all, we aren't that generation. I mean, we are the biggest social justice revolution since the 60s with Black Lives Matter and a lot of the feminists that I see on college campuses talking about sexual assault. We are an active generation. And two, we have been able to harness social media in a way that older generations don't really understand to actually affect change. So, you know, using your reusable bags back in the 90s and early 2000s, that's probably identity politics. But starting a hashtag revolution that actually informs policy and changes
minds.
Changes minds, but also changes corporate policy, changes people's minds. Like, yeah, it might seem shallow, but it actually has made a difference in several significant cases.
Well, look, let me give you a really good example. You don't follow sports like I do.
No.
The NBA announced, I think it was earlier today, that the 2019 All-Star Game is not going to be in Charlotte. Now, that might not sound like a big deal, but that brings in about $100 million of revenue that whole week.
Yeah.
Why an All-Star game would bring in that much money even boggles my mind as a sports fan, but it does. And this is because of McCrory's horrible HB2.
Yeah.
And that wouldn't have happened if not for quite a bit of social media and activism and pushback. I mean, obviously a lot of it at the business level, but why – Where are those business concerns coming from?
The pressure came from people like us who are sports fans, but probably of our generation, that said, this is bullshit. And you hear it enough times, the business community gets a little twitchy and they change policies. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, maybe it's identity politics, but at least ours work.
Well, and there's also something to be said, you know, since we're in a campaign season, we hear a lot about reaching individual voters and boots on the ground. And the number of people that I can visit in an afternoon knocking on individual doors versus the number of people that will read my opinion about something via Twitter, Facebook, and any of these things, just to be super meta about it, people listening to this podcast, we get to talk to people about our opinions about things in a way that doesn't require an actual face-to-face interaction. And I think there's a lot of people in an older style of politics that don't understand that, and they think that what we're just doing is shouting to the ether.
Yeah.
When in fact people do read that and
or listen to it. Absolutely.
Yeah, no, and you having long internet arguments with somebody is probably not going to win your mind, but when, you know, 80% of your interactions with somebody online shows that they have this particular opinion about a particular policy matter, odds are you're going to probably be won over on the idea, at least that it's popular.
Mm-hmm. But sort of backtracking just a little, you know, just the frustration with when we talked about, like, people like me would choose not to patronize Walmart or Mickey D's or whoever it was. And then you turn on MSNBC and they're like, McDonald's shares are down the past 2 months. And we're not sure why. Is it because, you know, Americans are eating healthier or there's not enough salad options? And I was just kind of like, wait a minute. I think maybe a bunch of young people are consciously doing other stuff.
Yeah.
And it's good to hear that this is being reported in trade magazines. I wish that message was getting out in the broader public. But what you're saying, Sarah, is that these corporations are taking notice of that kind of thing. And it is affecting some kind of change.
Corporations and definitely marketing firms all over the country get it. MSNBC probably can't even spell millennial. I mean, they put Luke Russert on as their millennial person. It's just like, really? Can he please take his boat shoes off while he's interviewing a member of Congress? I mean, seriously, that's not your millennial demographic.
Sorry to interrupt, but he had an amazing quote the other day. They were like doing his life story thing, and he's kind of like, well, you know, after the death of my father, which granted that was tragic when Tim Russert passed away, but I had this really horrible dilemma. I was out of college and I had to start working right away instead of going on a sabbatical or something.
What exactly do you do?
And you're like, oh no.
Oh, really?
Oh, that's terrible.
I can so relate to
you,
that.
You couldn't do your Julia Roberts and Eat, Pray, Love for 3 years? Or what? I mean, like, what are you saying? And how do you think that relates to
anyone of your generation?
And like you said, that's the person that MSNBC is going to be sticking. See, we're talking to millennials.
No.
And, like, they understand.
Talking to rich white people.
Honestly,
Ronan Farrow. They had Ronan Farrow up there as their other millennial. I know. What are you? You have no idea what you're doing.
No, and like, he had a couple okay things to say, but no. This is not. I mean, talk to somebody who worked three jobs to get through 7 years of college, and then I'll say we're on the same level.
No, that program was such a disaster. And I just want to interject one thing before we move on from this topic because I think we're probably getting close to it. Is just that I hate to be the cynical goth kid in the room. But you are. I am. So
it's either you or me.
Float the possibility that does anyone think it's possible that people are trying to make some of their wages a little bit better because they know if they don't, the push to a $15 an hour minimum wage might get stronger, and so if they can go from 11 to 12, then
so
we don't
like
have to
like
have
a Marx thing here.
We're talking about
a Marx thing, right? So Marx predicted the proletariat revolution because of poor working conditions and bad wages.
This is where I'm going.
And so
Mark or Marx?
Corporations.
Marx. Okay.
Yeah, Marx.
I thought you knew some guy named Mark because you're like,
yeah, no, Mark Marx.
Mark Marx.
Oh, Mark Marx?
No, Karl Marx.
His brother?
Right.
Karl's
so
brother.
Then corporations took note and made him just a little bit better. Better enough to not have people revolt in the streets. And everyone said,
precisely
oh, Karl Marx is wrong. What an idiot. And it's like, well, no.
No, he said no. He said this better change or this will happen. And then, you know, Henry Ford, Nazi sympathizer that he was, said, hey, I have an idea. This bullshit I'm building that only rich people can buy, if I paid my employees a little more, they could buy my bullshit too.
That's right.
And then I'll sell more bullshit and I'll get more money.
Yes.
Ding, ding, ding.
And that doesn't even work for
now. Now that doesn't work at all.
No.
Now
people who build houses
broken.
Don't often own them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't. I mean, Ford was whatever he was, but at least he did do that. At least he did say, "I'd like to pay every one of my workers enough to be able to afford the product that they produce." That's a good sentiment. I get that he wanted to sell more cars, but he did pay people more.
And hate the Jews.
Well,
of course.
Okay.
So just me floating that didn't set anyone's bullshit detector off too much. That you think that there might be something to that? That if we just appease them just enough, we don't have to start talking about
$60
an hour.
Yeah, absolutely.
Minimum
if
wages.
We just bump them up to 11, then
that'll shut them up for a
while.
We
save $4 an hour.
For every employee.
For every employee.
And then we could say, hey, look what we did. We rose. The
economy.
Oh, and it's such a sweet press release for them.
But you know what? That's the thing. In spite of that, bumping up a couple bucks an hour improves the economy all across the board.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Trickle up so economics, as you
I guess where that leads. And we
but
say, here's what we've calculated, it should trickle
wages.
Down as.
That's by hiring more people at low wages, really, not about increasing.
Right, because every
the
time they talk
wage.
About this is going to hurt
well, that's
employment
ridiculous.
Numbers.
Obviously, trickle down is ridiculous.
No, ridiculous.
How does anyone believe in it ever when it's been proven time and time again not to work is the question.
Sarah, maybe you could chime in on this.
Why they believe it.
This is the Colorado Tabor thing. Are we going to give every person in the state $7 back, or are we going to fund
invest
education?
$40 million in education.
Well,
yeah.
I want to hear what Sarah has to say about that.
It just makes me think of Sam Brownback.
Oh, God.
Oh, God.
And yes. Honestly, I would say, too, Mary Fallon in Oklahoma and Bobby Jindal in Louisiana did the exact same thing following suit. And we're seeing a good example of what happened. I mean, those economies are literally bankrupt. So, you know, I think a lot of people who own these corporations are... I think it's exactly like you said, they're just trying to get by with as little as they possibly can. And they have to figure out where that happy medium is and how they can then market it to, you know, other people and make some money off of it. So it's just like, you know, I'll get like 60% of millennials would support me if my company paid a living wage. Okay, well, I need the millennial generation to buy my shit. So I'm going to do... whatever they want. I mean, I think it's more sinister, honestly, than just being, I think they personally are in favor of these trickle down policies, but they're also capitalists and yeah. They'll do whatever it takes to make them more money. Even if it's contrary to what their beliefs are. They're like, I mean, look at Murdoch and Roger Ailes. That's a great example.
Right.
Like, Roger Ailes was sexually harassing all of these women, and the Murdochs, they don't give a shit. Like, they're
of course not.
No, of course not. They've known for decades, promise.
But at the same time, their audience is dying. Like, they're not going to be around in 20 years. So they got to start, the Murdoch kids have got to start figuring out, all right, you know, our biggest cash cow right now is Megyn Kelly. And if Megyn Kelly says that Roger Ailes is slapping women on the ass, then we've got to get rid of Roger Ailes. Because millennials like her and our old people audience, you know, love her as well. So, you know,
do
we
millennials
may...
really like her, though?
Conservatives.
I mean,
I think the
young Republicans, I'm sure. But
I think the only millennials that they've got like her.
Sure.
Right. And they got to keep those.
And they've got to keep those. And then they've got to spend the next, you know, like 5 years trying to figure out how to expand their audience. And I think that's where you're going to see the Murdoch boys step in. One of them's a Democrat. One of the Murdoch boys is a Democrat.
Wow.
The other one's,
I knew that.
The other one's a huge environmentalist.
Well, I think the Trump kids are all technically Democrats, too. Not that that, you know, amounts to anything in the grand scheme of things.
Ivanka surely trotted out her Democrat card.
Yeah, we're going to get to that in the second half.
I didn't watch it.
Before we got a couple minutes left before the break, but... and Dana is itching to get in with a comment.
I just wanted to say, if anyone's listening from the Pokemon Go company, every time Roger Ailes slaps someone's ass or a harassment lawsuit is brought up against him, a Pokestop is created. I think he could get the millennials on board.
It's a good one.
Gross.
Good one. Anyway, so one thing I wanted to ask you about, I don't know if you listen to a lot of podcasts like I do. I'm sort of a podcast junkie.
Me too.
And Sarah, do you listen to a lot of podcasts?
I did more whenever I was commuting. Right. Now my commute is from my bed to my couch.
Word.
Because I'm the only staffer in DC for the whole website.
Must
Everybody
nice.
Else is. Yeah, I mean,
that's hard to believe. You're the your only Raw Story writer in DC. Wow,
that's awesome.
We really try to stay out of the Beltway kind of bullshit and.
Right.
I think we have to have somebody here in case something happens. But we really try and report on the rest of the country and what's going on in the States, because that's really, honestly, it's the most important thing.
And I think you guys do a really good job of that.
I do too.
Cool.
We try. And I go home a lot. Like I'm from Oklahoma and, it's a scary place.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
But my mom yells at me if I don't come home enough. So, Because I'm a millennial and we have bizarre relationships with our family and our parents.
I know, right? Mm-hmm. I get shit for it all the time.
Of parentalized children.
Yes.
Anyway, so my point kind of was, I listen to a lot of these podcasts, like some of them are on NPR or state, you know, places like that. And they're like, well, now we're going to have this dude from Silicon Valley talk to millennials. And it's all geared towards this dude created this app or started this company and did this boot camp to learn how to have a startup. And listen, millennials, because this is how I'm like, this is the same bullshit they're peddling on the right. Like, everybody can be a CEO. Everybody can be a business owner. And if not, then you'll starve and too fucking bad. You just suck at life.
There's no social safety net. And so fuck you. You didn't pull yourself up quite hard enough by those bootstraps.
Right.
Well, and it's the Shark Tank philosophy, right? If everyone stumbles upon the right thing. You know, I think the 70s had their own version of it with the pet rock. Everyone thought that their next idea was going to be the next amazing.
But the reality of life in America is that most people will never become wealthy.
Right.
Most people will be at middle or lower class.
Well, that's the point, right? Like if you don't have that necessary talent, let's say, or maybe you have a learning disability or whatever the reason is.
Goddamn luck sometimes.
Luck.
That's what I was going to say. None of this is about talent or ability or cleverness or ideas. This is all about luck and entitlement. You don't see people very often who come from nothing and are able to climb to the top. That doesn't happen in our generation anymore.
Well, once in a blue moon it does, and then the right says, see,
they latch
look.
On and say, see, look, see,
there's
look.
One person out of 80 million that can do it.
Right.
That
so,
means you're all losers.
So that means this is, pull
again,
all the money out of public schools.
Generational gaslighting. This is telling us, well, if that guy did it, what's wrong with you? You're all assholes and losers, and what are you doing? You're lazy. And it's like, oh, 80 million of us are lazy. Obviously. That one guy, though, man, he's swell. Great.
Yeah. The one guy basically won the lottery. But anyway,
can I just say, I don't understand why older generations are trying to be so bitchy to us, because we're getting ready to take over their world and we're going to pay their Social Security, and they should really be nicer.
And write their laws and decide if they get to have Social Security.
Yeah, or stop voting for people who want to privatize it.
Yeah.
And Medicare, like,
I mean,
get
I
your damn government
you,
hands off my Medicare. I don't know.
They should maybe be a little sweeter to us little millennials, because we're taking over.
Well, and I
we're
going to
put them in the home.
we're about to become the generation who is becoming the next set of CEOs of all of these brand new amazing startups. We're about to become the next generation of politicians.
We're already taking over TV. Half the shit that's on TV now is just a direct, like, something from my childhood.
Well,
you know, like, they took Chris Hardwick out of the ether because I remembered him from Singled Out, and now he has an empire. Because I'm like, I remember that guy. That was funny.
Well, he's pretty talented, too.
Oh, he is. And motivated and hardworking.
He's also fucking
precious. I know.
I love Chris Hardwick.
He's
a national treasure.
But, like, he is my generation, and he is taking over TV to some extent.
And he used to work with Jenny McCarthy.
Yeah, we don't like her.
Jenny McCarthy is a fail, and Chris Hardwick is reigning supreme.
Exactly.
Right, and he was the
sidekick. But I love that he's taking over TV. I love it, because, like, he's me. So, yeah, we are taking over.
And things that were a little bit too old for us are starting to disappear. I mean, you know, I think, like, American Idol was a little bit too old for us. We didn't get into that.
I don't think anybody cared.
The people older than us did. It was a big deal.
I know my parents cared.
Yeah.
I don't know anybody that cared.
Well, because it was...
I don't know anybody in our generation who even watches network TV. So.
No, me either.
Well, American Idol was glorified Star Search, which was big in the 70s and
80s. Nobody that I know cared. My parents watched it religiously, and I was like,
well, that's what I'm telling you. That's a little bit older, so, you know. But anyway, on that note, we're gonna go to a quick break. And Sarah, I hope you stick around. Talk to us a little longer if you fancy. Great. So
we're gonna have to get into the RNC.
Oh yeah, yeah. We're gonna get into all that jazz.
Okay.
So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Love may live or love may die. Love may do or love may try. Love may make or love may break. Love may give or love may take. Either way, learn to
Hello and welcome back to Irreverent Testimony. We have Sarah Burris of RawStory.com on with us talking all things millennial politics and presidential politics. And the RNC wrapped up last night. And
I've got so much RNC fatigue right now. It's not even funny.
Yeah. And I guess the first thing we want to talk about, which was completely overshadowed by Trump's megalomaniacal Mussolini tirade, was his daughter's very progressive-ish speech.
I didn't hear it, so will you tell me about it?
I basically read the transcript and saw snippets. Sarah, did you see it in its entirety?
Totally. Okay. Oh, it freaked me out. And I honestly, it freaked everybody on Twitter out, too, from the left and the right. The left was like, wait, did I just fall asleep and wake up 3 years later? And find that the Republican Party is progressive now.
What did she say?
So she talked about being all for equal pay. She talked about paid family leave and giving mothers access to be moms and, you know, have normal jobs at the same time. And you're just like,
none of which is in the Republican platform, by the way.
Quite the opposite.
Yeah, it goes counter to
you should see my face right now.
And it's in the Democratic platform. Like, that shit's in there. And which David Axelrod tweeted, he was like, wow, you know, Ivanka Trump just totally promoted the Democratic platform at the RNC.
Or plagiarized it.
Taking a page out of Melania's book.
Maybe. Yeah, we haven't even gotten to that yet.
Okay, go ahead. So what else did she say?
I was talking about how she just basically hacked the RNC. And we all know she's a Democrat. So, you know, and I've totally poo-pooed people who have talked about how this is all a big conspiracy election and that Trump isn't really a Republican and he's just trying to take over the Republican Party.
Right.
And I've been like, oh, whatever, you guys are full of shit. But when you see shit like this, you're like, oh, damn.
Yeah, sometimes I don't think it's true. I think he's just a narcissist and an egomaniac and he just wants to win it. I don't think he wants to, like, actually do the job.
No,
he just wants to win. But then sometimes there's like these little glimmers and I'm like, oh my God, is that what we're doing?
When the email scandal broke for Clinton and he spent the entire weekend talking about Saddam Hussein being a really good dictator.
That was hard not to think that he had a secondary agenda.
No, but when you're completely undisciplined and have no attention span and don't really know how to run a campaign, it still fits.
No, I think that that's true, and I still think there's plausible deniability, but
because you've heard
several times I said that at some time in the RNC Rick Astley would show up and start singing on this podcast. I've promoted that.
But
that
Rick Astley did show up.
In Melania's speech, she said, Donald Trump will never give you up. Donald Trump will never let you down. And I was like, I fucking called
that. People are still trying to unravel what the fuck.
I heard someone say that it was the staff of the Trump campaign kind of signaling to the rest of us that they were trying to sabotage him because they knew that he wouldn't get it and she wouldn't get it. And no one was going to catch it. And so they were signaling to the rest of us like, lol, it's Rick Astley, Rick Roll.
It's possible.
So there's that crack.com video that is, what if Trump is really just a really big joke? It has the joke writers saying like, yes, we got the account. We're going to write Donald Trump's account.
This is all performance art.
Yeah. And it's
we've always like, speculated.
Isn't it going to be so funny when we let them know?
And it'll be even funnier when like the polls are tied and like, he's got an actual chance of possibly winning, which is what polls will look like probably in the next few days before the Democratic bump.
That is precisely the premise of that skit, is they can't ever release the punchline to that joke because he keeps doing so well.
Yeah. It's like Lost. The ratings are too good. We're out of material, but the ratings are through the roof. Just make shit up. Just film. Just, we don't have a script. Just film. Ad lib. Improv.
Drink and film.
Jesus. But anyway, back to Ivanka's speech. Yeah, it was disjointed and people are still trying to unravel it. And most of that got lost after the Donald speech, obviously.
Yeah. and then his complete meltdown today about Ted Cruz.
Well, that's another thing, right?
Like, it's the classic. Travis calls it every time. He's like, Donald Trump will give an on-teleprompter speech because it's crucial and vital and critical, and his handlers make him read it.
Yeah.
And then Travis always says, like, I swear to God, give him 12 hours, and he's going to pop off. And that's exactly what happened this morning. And it was like, all right. I mean,
yeah, but that starts to make you think, though, that there's something more going on than him just being completely undisciplined and out of control. And I mean, like, is this some kind of weird performance art? The problem is, I don't see Trump as that being sophisticated enough to do that. Really?
Yeah, I know, right? Either he really is the biggest narcissist in the world, who is so full of himself and so ADD and
which is plausible,
and self-obsessed, or he really truly is the smartest person on the planet.
And that's, I think, harder for me to believe. The former is probably more accurate.
Well, I don't know. I start to get.
I mean, he's probably just a narcissist.
It's like when you watch the Wizard of Oz with Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, and there's all these weird coincidences, and you would love to believe that somehow they meant to do it, but you know they really
didn't.
It's just a weird coincidence. That's got
to
be what this is.
It has to be.
There's like, a huge cynical part of my brain, though, that goes like, okay, so if, like, let's take Melania Trump, for instance. Her speech was never going to be something that was going to make a super huge hit on the news cycle unless there's a scandal associated with it. So
right,
if you manufacture a scandal by doing something
and a weird
rickroll
in
like,
it,
plagiarizing
Michelle Obama. Of all people.
Melania's speech is
not Eleanor Roosevelt, not Nancy Reagan, not like any conservative darling, Michelle Obama.
The second most reviled
and
person
by the
Republicans.
The thing that they talked about in the New York Times article about the speech was they said that the speech writers, you know, Trump's campaign staff came out and said, you know, 1, 2, 3, not it.
Yeah.
We're not, we had nothing to do with this. And the speech that we had prepared that we gave to her that, you know, a couple nights before had none of this shit in it.
Went into the garbage, essentially. Well, like, did not show up that night. They were like, what the fuck is she talking about right now?
And nobody has an explanation.
And then
which
this
means that
mysterious Meredith MacIvor comes out.
I like that.
Dancing English major.
I mean, what? I smell bullshit. I don't know.
It is also
weird.
Every news
report about it conflicts. You know, Melania was quoted as saying, you know, the speech that I wrote, and then also quoted as saying the speech that I read once before I read it. And then,
no, she read it to this person who read it back and then didn't remember.
Like, every news report's completely different.
I know.
This is why it stinks to me.
Well,
like,
he's melting down.
Let's just try to keep this
in
the news as much as possible.
You can't criticize him or his wife. And so he made up literally everything he could think of to try to protect her.
But this is another thing,
guys. And then ultimately had to come out
with this. But not just this. Every time something even whiffs of bad press, it's like Trump immediately goes, ooh, I better blow this thing up.
Pour gasoline on
the fire. Pour gasoline on it. And you either do that because you are a completely undisciplined egomaniac with a super fragile ego.
Yes.
Or you really are playing some kind of weird game.
You're a marketing genius.
Your brain starts to melt a little bit when you're like, this doesn't make sense. But at the same time, it's working. He's gaining in the polls somehow.
Which I think even surprises him. Go ahead,
he's doing it almost like it's a TV show promotion, you know, where everybody always says any press is good press.
No, he literally said
that.
That's
his number one
day.
Quote is there's no such thing as bad press. He says it all the time, even as he's been running.
Which is how Hollywood works, right? Like that is everything that Taylor Swift should have taught our generation, is that any press is good press. And so
and people release their own sex tapes now, right? Yeah.
Exactly. So for the first time ever, we have a candidate who is operating like he is in the Taylor Swift bubble, or he's running like a Hollywood candidate. But, you know, politics, we're not used to this. Like, we're buttoned up and you know, controlled. And so the political world, people are just like, oh, my God, he did not do that. That's such suicide. But
well,
then it's not.
Well, but that's what I think at the end of the day. When people finally go to the polls and say, okay, now we actually have to pick a president, a leader of the free world.
I don't know.
I don't think there's enough that are going to say, I really want this crazy TV show to keep going.
I don't really know about that.
Trump
2016 goes the way of Ghostbusters 2016, and it does turn out there's such a thing as bad press.
Honestly, there's no more racist trolling. I mean, we had enough of that.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people who are really, really stupid and are going to cast really dumb votes. I just hope that people don't think about it as being fictional. And I worry that they do, because we have these reality shows now that aren't reality. We call them reality, but it's completely scripted to appear as though it's reality.
Of course.
Right.
And I worry that people see this as just another reality show, and it's not.
Well, and I think to your point, when we watch these reality shows, they're scripted, and the end is always what the public wants it to be. And so I saw that with Brexit. You know, people thought, oh, this is fun, and I'm going to vote to leave the EU, and I don't really know what I'm doing, but it's going to all be fine because the producers will make it so that we're still in the EU, but I made a protest vote. And I'm like, that's what terrifies me about Donald Trump, is people don't realize that, no, that was the vote. That
wasn't
means
a practice
now... That's your candidate.
Real.
This is reality. That's now the fucking president
of
the United States.
Well, the new prime minister is trying to slow play that. Technically.
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the vote. Like, the fact that the majority of the UK voted to leave the EU, and then there was this giant hangover the next day, and they were like Googling furiously, what is Brexit? What did I just vote for? Do we get a revote? And it's like, oh my God.
A revote.
No, no, this is not a produced reality show. This is voting, and this is the future of your country and the future of the world. And I'm with you, Sarah. Like, I worry that people don't get that.
Well, and I'd like to bring up a thing, because, Sarah, you mentioned Taylor Swift, and she's been a lot in the news lately, and I've been avoiding every article about this entirely until there was one article that said, like, the entire controversy, like, just kind of broken down point by point. And, Travis, you might know the term that I'm thinking of. I can't call it to mind right now, but in professional wrestling, there's a term for when you're faking.
An
argument.
Yes.
I want to say it's...
Like, I forgot, but yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Somebody called it that, and I had to look up what that term even meant. But once I read into the thing, I was like, wait, even our reality stars' actual realities are scripted.
Yes.
Yeah, of
because
course.
As it turns out, that article pointed out is, like, this entire controversy is manufactured to keep their names in the news.
That's right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
People are even questioning whether she's actually in a relationship with whoever that dude is that she's in a relationship with, because they're like, oh, this could be a promo for her new record or whatever.
But what difference does it make? Because those celebrity relationships usually last a month or two anyway.
Or isn't she getting married to Thor's brother, and then
the whole point
the other
is
one's
that
marrying Loki?
You were saying the other podcast, Dana, was that when you go on Twitter and things like Brexit get the same kind of trending coverage and the same kind of almost perceived value as something like Taylor Swift and Kanye's feud, that somehow kind of warps our minds and makes us not understand the gravity of actual news and the gravity of what some bullshit celebrity drama is.
I mean, that's what I was ultimately getting at. That plus the point that even when people seem to be making intentional choices, they might actually be for showbiz purposes. And that seems to be the way that things are operating
now. I want to step in and sort of challenge that premise, because I think most people can compartmentalize a little better than that. Like, you know, I'm furiously Twittering all day to find out latest political news, and then I'm going to go to see the latest NFL news. And I'm not necessarily taking them the same level of seriousness at my core.
Yes, but
maybe I just need a break.
But you are also a person who follows politics very closely and understands kind of gravity. And I just worry that the way the news used to be fed to us was like the nightly news, and there was this kind of like import to it, like this is big. And when you go to trending topics, I worry that people who aren't paying close enough attention or grew up this way don't understand like the gravity of one thing versus something else.
Well, and I'd like to peg off that and say, when we start talking about things that are trending, it's not necessarily that it's important. It means people are talking about it.
Right.
And the way that you keep something trending is keep the conversation going.
Right.
Not necessarily make it any more important.
Right. And there's no distinction there on Twitter, at least. Or really anywhere. It's just
Facebook, 24-hour cable news, any of these things. It really doesn't matter. It just matters that people are talking
about
it. But
now cable news is trying to sort of emulate that social media sound bite, quick hitting, scrolling.
Sarah, you're a part of the media.
Yeah, this is all
so
your fault.
How about you tell us what you think
tell
about
all
that?
Tell us what you did wrong, Sarah.
Well, here's the thing, and I actually talked about this to somebody else the other day. The media is a capitalist empire. And when you have all these people who want to click on stories or watch stories that are sensationalized bullshit, like Donald Trump doing something crazy or throwing gas on the fire and all of these things, it makes them more money. So they keep doing it. They keep reporting it. And we end up in this cycle where Trump gets more and more and more coverage for free because he's throwing more and more gas on the fire for these absurd stories that get him more coverage for free. And people are making more money off of it.
Right.
So, I mean, I do the same thing every day where you see Trump doing something insane and we know if we cover it, we're going to get so many views out of it.
Yeah.
And
advertising revenue. And
exactly. And so you have this responsibility where it's like, okay, we're going to write about the absurd Trump story. We have to make sure that, you know, obviously we're writing this story to a specific progressive audience. We're not writing it to inform middle of the road voters. Like, let's be honest, right?
Right.
We're not changing hearts and minds. Hopefully, though, we are enraging the left enough to make sure that they're getting out to the polls. And, you know, certainly if they don't want to knock doors for Hillary, they'll go knock doors for somebody locally that shares their values.
But here's my problem.
Which they should do,
with that,
by the way.
Sarah. My problem with that is when the right gets enraged, you can be damn sure they are going to get out to vote.
Mm-hmm.
When the left gets enraged, a good portion of them get depressed and say, "F it, I'm tuning out. I'm staying home."
Especially with this level of crazy, it's really hard not to start to think like you're taking fucking crazy pills.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But I mean, sort of back to the Trump thing, and then I know we've harped on this for forever in this segment, but again, so what happened today? Well, Trump knew that after his big speech today, Hillary was going to give a big counter speech and announce her VP pick, which means she was going to dominate the news cycle. So what
he
does he
something fucking nuts.
So what does he say this morning? He revives the Ted Cruz's dad killed JFK thing, which is batshit insane. There's no reason to do that the day after you gave your acceptance speech.
That so everyone lauded as like very controlled and yay, yeah, good job. And
yeah,
he's
so,
like, fuck that. This guy, blah.
Look at him with Lee Harvey Oswald. Mic. Isn't that crazy?
There's a picture
isn't
of them
it
and having breakfast.
That Ted Cruz
so.
Is
the Zodiac killer? Yeah. But no, so my question is there a method to the madness, Sarah, or is this guy just a lunatic?
You know, I have no clue at this point.
What does your gut tell you?
I mean, I for the longest time, I dismissed this being part of his big ploy. And I honestly think that you're right. I think that he can stay on message for only so long. And then it just gets under his skin. And you see this with Hillary Clinton. And that's why I think maybe it really is this narcissist thing where she will she'll throw up a new ad right before he's supposed to do something really important.
Yes.
And it'll say something or do something that just gets under
it'll troll
his
skin. Him,
yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, she's essentially Hillary Clinton has some brilliant communications person who is like an expert in Trump psychology. And
it's so easy. I mean, my God. It's so
easy.
And
you saw this with Mike Pence, where he's supposed to get up there, announce Mike Pence, let Mike Pence give his fucking, you know, speech about Republican blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And instead he gives a 28-minute speech railing on whatever the hell crazy-ass bullshit and completely destroying the story. And then and like drops the mic and leaves before Mike Pence is even done.
I mean, he didn't even say like Mike Pence's name for the first like 85% of it. He was just railing on whatever crazy random shit. And he was like, oh, and by the way, I guess we're here to announce my VP.
Well, he didn't want him. This is what we're here.
Well, yeah, that.
Or letting Ted Cruz come up and talk before Mike Pence and not endorse and know that that wasn't going to happen. And then that's the news story, the next cycle. Like, the campaign's a mess.
And he may have
it's
orchestrated.
A mess.
Or unless, well, he may have orchestrated that to humiliate Ted Cruz.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering, too. There's two ways you can go on this. Or one, he did it because he knew that it would hurt Ted Cruz in the end. Or his people are so inept that when they looked at the text of the speech, they thought, you know, vote your conscience up and down the ballot. They didn't realize, oh, no, that's the language that the Never Trump people are using.
Right.
They had no idea because they're, I mean, most of the people who are involved in the Trump organization at the top levels are not political people. They're not paying attention to what's going on in actual politics. They run it like a business.
And
there's no way that they didn't have that catchphrase "Vote your conscience" come across their desk at any point in time doing.
Well,
what
they may
do.
Have just missed it.
Well, they
they may have saw that. I mean, when they saw that, they said they looked at it in terms of like that whole sentence. If you look at that excerpt of what they sent out to the press.
Sorry for the technical difficulties there. So this is going to be weirdly edited. Sorry about that. But we were talking about the RNC
and Trump.
And Ted
Trump.
Cruz.
Ted Cruz.
We were talking about how Ted Cruz, I think, honest to God, the Trump people are business folks. They're not the folks who are used to politics. They don't know the ins and outs of politics. And so when they read that sentence, you know, in the middle of Ted Cruz's speech that just said vote your conscience up and down the ballot, they thought that it meant vote your conscience up and down the ballot. They did not think, oh, shit, this is the language that the Never Trump people actually use. And so after that floor fight on Monday, and then Ted Cruz pulls out this same language, of course, the whole audience is going to lose its mind. But the Trump people had to have been going, I don't get it.
What happened? Well,
that's entirely possible. When you think about how many different kind of subgroups of people at the RNC are supposed to be represented, you know, we start talking about the evangelicals, like the hardcore Tea Partiers, and I mean, there's so much code switching language things there that I bet there's a lot of things that slip by.
But that shouldn't slip by.
Even Trump, when he was asked by MSNBC, said, oh, I thought the speech was great. I loved it. And then 12 hours later, he's like ripping into Ted Cruz.
Well, hold on.
I don't think he understood either that.
Yeah.
Or he understood too well. What if the alternative is true? That somebody, one of his handlers was competent and said, he's not endorsing you. Sure. Yeah, let him do the speech. And then
I don't want his endorsement anyway.
And then he made sure that all the whips booed the crap out of him so he could personally humiliate Ted Cruz. But again,
Ted Cruz won this news cycle because he came back and said, I am not in the business of endorsing or helping people who attack my wife and attack my father, and I'm not about to be fake.
But did that win him anything?
I think so. I do. I think a lot of people said,
we won't know that for 4 years.
The only guy who has any kind of ethics
conscience
is Ted Cruz. So I think he did himself a lot of favors.
People that will never, ever vote for him.
Well, and he's not up for anything.
I just think, overall,
he's running in 2020. I think that's what that whole speech was.
Well, but that's my point. We don't know if that worked. Look, if Trump loses and it's close, then they could very well look at Cruz as a splitter and point the finger at him. Ironically, the establishment. Now, if he just gets blown the fuck out, and then they can, you know, go back to the whole line. Oh, you didn't nominate a true conservative.
And you do that some more.
I see that move. That's a good move.
That's if Trump loses badly.
Yeah, it's a good move either way.
But that's a pretty good gamble by Cruz.
I mean, if he loses badly, it sets Cruz up for 2020. If he loses narrowly,
he could take some heat.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he could still say, like, look, I was right. Donald Trump lost. Maybe it's by
five points. Maybe it's not.
Donald Trump lost.
5 points
I didn't endorse him. I was right. I think it's a good move for him either way because I think he knows Trump's going to lose.
I mean, honestly, the fact that we're talking about Trump losing by a 5-point margin
instead of a 20-point margin?
But 5 points is like 100-plus electoral votes.
Yeah, no, but I know. 5 points should be the total number of points that he gets at all.
Yes, but we are in this strange alternate reality. Well, we're in the baked-in 30% are going to vote Dem. 30% are going to vote R.
Yeah.
You know, whatever else from there. But what Sarah, what else was memorable from you from the RNC as just being jaw-dropping or stupid or interesting or horrifying? Or
the mentions of LGBTQ people. Every time somebody got up on stage and talked about the gay community, I was floored. One, I was floored that somebody had the balls to get up there and say the acronym. Two, I was floored that they didn't get booed.
No, and I'm more cynical than you, but go on. I'll give you my take in a second.
I do think that it's all a big ploy to try and go after the LGBT vote.
Sure.
I don't think
cynical.
It's ever going to happen.
No, no.
Obviously. And didn't the guy from the Log Cabin Republicans talk? Didn't he give a speech? And
I don't know if he did, but Peter Thiel did.
His name is like something.
Yeah, Peter Thiel did.
Yeah, yeah. And what does he say to his people? What?
They're not his people. He's a billionaire.
Yeah. I'm saying, what does he say to the gay community? I'm a part of this most anti-LGBT Republican platform in history. Hi, I'm gay. I'm here to talk to you about why you should vote Republican. What the fuck do you say?
He doesn't
I know
care.
Exactly. Like the history of the Republican Party has been this hands-off small government, and yet this is the one place where the Republican Party has always intruded on people's personal lives, and you're like, wait, I thought you were the small government party.
Or reproductive rights, right?
Not just small
enough to fit in my vagina.
Yeah.
And not just historically have they always been terrible on this issue. This is one of the worst anti-LGBT party platforms we've seen in a long
time. Nobody pays attention to the platforms
ever.
Except for
us. I mean, the
us.
Platform is, I mean.
No, it's horrific. But at the end of the day, your average voter is not going to know a goddamn thing that was in the party.
But
platform.
We should talk about it. I think it's a backlash. I think it wasn't this anti-LGBT in 2000 or 2004 or 2008 when there was the most public anti-LGBT rhetoric going on. I think this platform is backlash against the progress that our movement has made.
And then the juxtapose is that ultimately the speakers actually get up there and say blah, blah, LGBT rights. And then the delegates don't boo, but that's they're equally cynical. One, the speakers and the party and Rince Priebus knows they have to give that lip service, and the delegates are going to be there and put on a fake smile and said, they have to say this. We have to try to reach out to these people. Obviously we hate their guts and we think they're going to hell, but yeah, LGBT rights. I mean, it's all very cynical.
So is this just
crazy?
A further attempt at hedging your bets to say, some people are going to pay attention to the platform. Some people are going to pay attention to what people said. And so everyone's going to find something they can like. The people who hate the LGBTQ community can say, yeah,
yes.
That,
look at the
that
platform.
Person said that, but the platform says
right,
this.
Right, it's pandering,
and what
it's pandering across the board.
Is that,
right.
Yeah.
Whereas the DNC, they're going to talk the talk and walk the walk.
What do you
and
think,
it's
Sarah?
Be on the platform.
No, I agree. And I the interesting thing, though, I think is that I would hope that people who are actually LGBTQ know what the platform says and understand why it's a problem. And I hope that those folks are talking to their friends and allies so that
right.
they can understand it. I can't imagine a huge number of LGBT people supporting Trump.
No.
A few. But you know, at the end of the day, we sort of make this.
But it's what she's saying is that if you are LGBT and you have straight people in your life that might vote Republican, probably behooves you to talk to them about the platform.
Yes, but
my point is
orientation has nothing to do with whether you're overtly political or not.
No. Well, right. I don't know. That's actually, I would disagree with that a little bit.
Well probably more than the general population.
We have been made more political than straight people have been.
Across the board. There's plenty of LGBT people out there that don't pay that much attention.
The percentage of LGBT people that are more aware of politics than straight people are much higher, same as people of color, pretty much any minority, because we're sort of thrust into the politics of the world in a very public way.
You would think, but the numbers don't always back that up.
I think they do. I think not as high as I'd like, but I would say more LGBT people in my life are political than straight people, and the percentages are not.
Well,
the same.
Ultimately, so, he's going to. I'm sorry, go ahead, Dan.
No, I was just going to say if you think about just the simple fact that when a lot of state laws determine what is and is not available in your particular area, and those things are subject to radical change,
mm-hmm.
Not necessarily radical just in scope, but also, you know, they're often proposed quickly, put into motion quickly, overturned quickly. These kind of things actually add turmoil to your life. I'm thinking specifically like if you're trans right now in a North Carolina.
Sure. Or a woman of reproductive age in Texas.
The state house bills have to say about
yeah.
what bathroom you can and cannot do as a daily activity. You need to know these things and know what's being proposed and struck down and these sorts of things.
And then show up in midterm elections, which is going to lead me to my next point.
Right.
So,
but I do think that I think LGBT voters became a little bit complacent after we got marriage equality from the Supreme Court. I think what has reactivated us is the shooting in Orlando.
Absolutely.
And that has reignited the conversation about people who are homophobic to the extreme that they're ready to wage a war against us and that we will readily sell them an AR-15 to do it. Yeah. So
I think the bathroom bills too have sparked some conversation. I think particularly, again, going back to millennials, that we are much more sensitive to trans issues than maybe some of the older LGBT people that I know. And so I think that's been something that has sparked our generation, particularly feminists in our generation sort of have rejected this rad femme idea that like trans women aren't women and that whole disgusting notion that happened during the second wave that I think our generation has sort of embraced trans people as part of the feminist movement and as part of the LGBT movement.
Well, and
thank goodness.
Yeah.
It's about time. And it's interesting that you mentioned that as energizing the base on the Democratic side. I read an article today that was essentially the counter argument to that, which is that a lot of the energy that we're seeing coming from the right wing is coming from the backlash against the bathroom bills and how they feel like we have gone completely just off the deep end as a country if we think that it's perfectly acceptable to go the entire other direction on this. It energizes our base to undo some of these bills, but the fact that we have come out in such force against them has energized the other side to say, like, what the fuck is happening to the
country? That's the backlash that I was talking about, you know?
Well, we're almost running out of time, so I kind of want to wrap this up into a larger theme. And we're talking about getting millennials and young Gen Xers into the process, making sure they vote in midterms, because we always forget about the damn midterms. Republicans are able to motivate their base and get them out to vote. We can't.
Looking at you, 2010.
Whatever. Yeah. 2014. Whatever reason, we can't do it in off years, and that's when the really horrible people at the local and state level get into office and make these awful bills.
That's right.
So here's my point, and I want to loop this all the way back around to the beginning and Tim Kaine. A lot of us are very disappointed that we got Tim Kaine.
That's me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I am.
And my point is, and you guys may not like this, we didn't deserve much better in the grand scheme of things. And let me explain what I mean by that. If you're on Clinton's team and you're looking at the raw numbers, the hard numbers, and you're saying, who's going to come out to vote? Who really matters? Who came out in 2014? Who came out even in the primaries? Do we have to go and get somebody who's really going to appeal to these millennials?
Or who do we want to
get a non-threatening, milquetoast white guy who the moderate soccer mom in the Virginia and Pennsylvania suburbs is going to feel okay about and not threatened by in any way, shape, or form?
Well, I think we're sticking away from trying to appeal specifically to the moderate soccer mom vote after 2008.
We're obviously not. That's my point. And my point to a greater degree is when you still look, even in the primaries, at who shows up consistently to vote, we're not doing it in great enough numbers yet where we are forcing a Hillary Clinton. Now, we did force her to adopt a lot of policy positions that were to the left of where she was, thanks to the Bernie movement.
Right.
But in terms of going as far as to name a really progressive running mate or one that specifically
stirs that Bernie Sanders
vote. That's right.
Yeah.
Where is the impetus to do it?
Because
is it in
vote.
The promise that we're all going to show up to vote? No.
There's no evidence that that's true.
Well, and we've been promising not to.
All she hears from the Bernie bros and the Bernier busters is, fuck you, I'm not going to vote, or I'm going to vote for Trump, so why appeal to them?
Well, that's sort of part of it. We get into this paradox where the counter argument is, well, yeah, we're sitting out because you're not appealing to us enough. And then her people are looking at, I
think her look, people are looking at it and saying, I don't think it matters what she does. Some of these people on Twitter and some of these Bernie or bust people are never going to vote for Hillary Clinton. Appeal to them?
I'm talking historically.
Appeal to the soccer mom.
I'm talking macro. I'm talking looking at the numbers.
I understand.
Cycle after cycle after cycle.
Who votes?
We have not shown up in large enough consistent numbers to say, hey, you have to directly appeal to us.
Yes.
Which is the thing that drives me absolutely insane, because we're the people who have to live with this stuff longer than anybody else.
So why don't we vote then?
It's a big part of why I've been a push to lower the voting age. And that's really, I mean, these people, the younger you are, the more longer you're affected by whatever policy gets put into place. And you're looking at it from that point of view. What is this going to look like 45 years down the road? Not what is this going to look like 4 years down the road?
But Travis is right. The reason they picked Tim Kaine is because the people that consistently come out to vote probably prefer him. And the people who prefer a more progressive candidate are not consistent and do not consistently come out to vote. And so why appeal to them? And then add on top of that, that they've said, fuck you, we're not voting for you. What's the impetus? What's why?
Look, and playing devil's advocate for a second. Once you dive deep on Tim Kaine, he's not horrible. We just feel she could have done so much better and more interesting and more exciting.
How about more inclusive? How about including someone on the ticket who proved to the Latinx community that we were actually committed to their values? Or,
well, she could make an argument. Hey, I'm the first major woman candidate. I've got the glass ceiling thing covered.
So I can't really deal with Mexicans or Cubans or whatever.
No.
Like,
can only do one thing at a time.
We can only do one thing at a time.
It's got to be one minority at the top of the ticket,
and
then
an
the old crusty
boring white
dude
at the
bottom.
But look,
time.
She also has her personal reasons. She goes way back with Kaine. She knows him. She trusts him. He's done a lot of work for her with the Clintons. She feels very comfortable with him. I get that. But we are not forcing her to go outside that and say, maybe I do a little bit of a reach. Do something, quote, crazy, like put an Elizabeth Warren on the ticket. Go for a Tom Perez. Look at a Joaquin Castro, Booker.
Cory Booker.
I mean,
anybody.
The weird thing for me about it is just that she's got such a history in Washington, which is part of why she gets so much flack, is because she's got, you know, a record that's so long that, you know,
we can look back and see all the things.
Basically, no way you're not going to find something to take offense at. And she went with somebody that she doesn't necessarily have, in that time frame, a really close record of serving with or running with or being partnered with. I kind of expected something a little more tied to the Clinton campaign.
No, he has been.
Tim Kaine?
Yeah.
I mean, he's been involved with her, but it's not been... I was expecting somebody that, you know...
No, he's as close at working with the Clintons as pretty much anybody.
Yeah, now, he's pretty far up there.
Yeah, yeah. Vilsack to maybe a slightly greater degree, but he's a little
older.
That's
kind of where I was heading, was Vilsack.
Well, he's a different shade of vanilla.
Sure.
And I think, too, when you look at Virginia, particularly the thing that happened today... you're going to need somebody to fight for that state.
It's a key state.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm just
so, and I don't think we're going to win Iowa. I mean, it would be nice if Iowa was in play, but I doubt it.
Yeah.
It will be.
I agree.
The thing too, I mean, I think this goes both ways. I think that young people and even the Bernie folks have to commit to, being involved, and maybe it's not involved in the Clinton campaign, but you know, the first thing that is going to happen after the election is all of these state parties are going to start holding their conventions, and they're going to vote for state legislative delegates. They're going to have people who are going to be on their roster for the next 4 years making decisions. And if you want to make a difference, then you got to show up to that shit.
And we're going to be part of that.
That's actually already what we already are doing.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what our whole podcast is about. Yeah, exactly that.
The other part of it is, you know, hopefully the Democratic Party will start reaching out to millennials. I sent you guys that link to the article that was in The Hill, where Democrats have really, they've really squandered a generation. And you're like, oh my God, dude, like this is a big deal, where you have the largest generation of in history. We've got 80 million people and you're not going after them. And I feel like I've been harping on this since 2006, where I'm like, dude, the numbers are here. You guys need to talk to young people. Even if you feel stupid, even if they don't like your policies. Even if you're walking into a room where you know it's not going to be a friendly atmosphere, you have to engage. You have to hear them, because if you don't, people are going to look at Washington and be like, well, fuck it. I mean, exactly. Why should I?
Exactly. They're not going to listen to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, am I being naive and thinking that Hillary's going to have to do that? She tries.
She hits and misses.
I mean, really get in there and do like college town hall type things. And
I wish that she would. I think if she doesn't, regardless of if she does or doesn't, she is the last candidate that we will have who doesn't do that, who is ignoring
it. Has an option.
Really, don't you think somebody picks up the Bernie playbook and tries this? And they're not like a 78-year-old Jewish guy from Vermont, and maybe even has as much success. I mean, he was great at getting that message across, obviously.
But he's very practiced at that message, and I mean, his stump was on point, and it was basically the same thing every time.
Even though
and
it was often one note, it was a note that was
very
resonating.
One
note. It resonated with a lot of people.
But he also had the sort of history to back him up too.
Yeah. I think where Hillary runs into issues is the way that she tries to connect to the younger generation is through really shitty dad jokes. She said something the other day about
Tim Kaine's going to fix that
Pokemon Go until one of you in amazing developers comes up with Pokemon Go to the polls.
Yeah, she was
I thought it was cute, but she was reading that
phonetically. She might as well have been like reading a Chinese greeting.
I hated diplomats. That. I mean, I half expected her today to say something about, did you guys hear about the thing with Taylor Swiftly Go to the polls?
Oh my god!
Oh, you think she's got Pokemon Go on her BlackBerry? State Department issue BlackBerry.
The fucking Pokemon already. I'm so done.
Did you guys hear about the press conference at the State Department that was interrupted by what's his name? The spokesman is Kirby. And he looks over at this reporter and he goes, "You're playing that Pokemon Go game, aren't you?" and the reporter's like, "I'm just keeping an eye on it." He's like talking about the ISIS coalition, people at the coalition of countries that are fighting against ISIS. And then all of a sudden, so he finishes his sentence and he goes back to the reporter and he goes, "Did you get one?" And I was like, right
what
on.
The fuck
you
is
know,
happening?
That's cool.
Oh my God.
I refuse to install that app on my phone.
I'm fully engaged.
Dana loves it.
Generational thing here.
I'm all about it.
No, I'm older than he is by like 2 months. And if I hear another Pokemon Go story, swear to God, I'll burn the building down.
I know I'm surrounded
like, I'm
by
done.
People who hate it and hate hearing about it, but I will say, I just have to at least
the
small
other half
small
of your people also love it, so that, I don't know. Talk to them about
it. I have been, for the last week and a half, walking around at night, after work, going to parks and stuff that I would probably never have ever gone to. And I'm seeing about 200 people sometimes in places where they definitely would never have ever been in that park either. Looking at pieces of art, and they're all designated as Pokestops. There's just
Dana's engaging his community, he's meeting
all
people.
Sorts of things, and you're meeting people and talking about where people
the
are
the app
from.
Is taking you to all
and
the
I'm
best glory holes in town.
Exercise.
People are doing exercise, and it's people ranging in age from like 8 to 60 walking around with their phones out. And yeah, we all got our faces down because we're all trying to catch something. Or whatever, but there's this kind of sense of community that, somebody will walk around and be like, "Hey, I don't know if you've been to the other side of the lake or not, but over there there's a bunch of XYZ."
Then
a bunch of people will all flock together in a group and go to the other side of the park, and probably a place that they've never been on that side of that lake in their neighborhood.
It would be a good idea to combine the Pokemon thing with going to the polls or something.
Oh, yeah, no, we're doing it.
Yeah, we're definitely doing Pokestops.
Yeah. Dana's going to take Daphna out to go Pokemon Go.
Great.
All right.
Anyway, on that note, Sarah, thank you so much for joining
us.
Please, please come back at some point.
Yes.
I would love to.
Anytime you want. You just let us know.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's lovely to have you.
So that's going to do it for us. Once again, we are going to have some cool guests coming up, possibly some folks linked with local Black Lives Matter people. Some more local Colorado candidates are on the slate, and a whole bunch of more cool stuff.
Got some local police.
Yeah, we're trying to get some local law enforcement as well.
To get their side.
Yeah.
So, as usual, I've been Travis.
I'm Rachel.
I'm Data.
And thanks again, Sarah Burris of rawstory.com. And follow her on Twitter. What's your Twitter handle again?
@SarahBurris.
Easy enough. And check us out at Irreverent Duo on Twitter. Hate mail to irreverentduo@gmail.com.
I'm sorry, reverenttestimony@gmail.com. Yes, right. I'm sure all of you boomers out there, we're going to get a bunch of hate mail. So
well, at
we
least,
welcome it.
At least from one Arliss, I'm sorry. Maybe. You can.
We love you, Arliss. You can come make
and tell
your
us
point.
How wrong we are.
Yeah. Just send it directly to me.
Okay.
All right.
Good
stay
night.
Active.
Stay active, stay tuned, stay involved. Adios.
Bye.
I just can't seem to let go. Burning hurt as my stomach churns, I'll never let you go. Black and blue covered, wilted, welted, bruised, I could never